Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the many mentions of Deutsche Bank in Michael Cohen's testimony before the House Oversight Committee last week and investigate Trump's ties to the only major bank willing to lend him money after defaulting on loans with his many bankruptcies. David Enrich, the finance editor at the New York Times and author of a forthcoming book on Deutsche Bank, joins us to discuss the likelihood that congressional investigators will now focus on Trump's dealings with a bank which has been sanctioned with large fines for money laundering. We will trace the history of this 150-year-old bank, which helped the Nazis build Auschwitz and later pursued Wall Street riches, and in doing so decided to back a self-promoting real estate promoter, Donald Trump, who most banks had blackballed. We will examine Deutsche Bank's role in manipulating markets, violating international sanctions, and laundering money for Russian oligarchs, as well as the mysterious death of its American executive, Bill Brokesmith, considered the conscience of the bank, who was found hanged in his London apartment. Then, with Bernie Sanders' huge rally in Brooklyn and the gathering of Democratic candidates on Sunday in Selma, Alabama, we will look into the growing number of candidates entering the race to replace Donald Trump and speak with Mike Lux, the president of American Family Voices and co-founder of Progressive Strategies, whose latest book is How to Democrat in the Age of Trump. He joins us to discuss how best to neutralize the orchestrated Republican attack on progressive candidates labeled as socialists, with socialism being defined as what is happening in Venezuela. He argues that candidates should focus on the reality that social democracy in Europe and next door in Canada has raised living standards for all citizens, while in America we have socialism for the 1%. Then finally, with Trump's announcement at CPAC in the midst of a two-hour rant of grievances mixed with delusions over the size of the crowd at his inauguration, along with unpresidential obscenities, we'll examine Trump's vow to issue an executive order that could strip colleges of funding if they don't support what he calls free speech. Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and author of Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue, joins us to analyze what free speech on campus means. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is David Enrich, who is the finance editor at the New York Times. He previously was the financial enterprises editor of the Wall Street Journal, heading a team of investigative reporters, and before that was the journal's European banking editor based in London, as well as a reporter in New York. He's the author of The Spider Network, How a Math Genius and a Gang of Scheming Bankers Pulled Off One of the Greatest Scams in History, and his forthcoming book on Deutsche Bank is coming out in early 2020. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Enrich.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you, David. And I imagine after these hearings with the mentions of Deutsche Bank and the interest now, and I think the very real likelihood that the congressional investigators will start looking closer at Deutsche Bank, your book is – are you going to accelerate its release, or are you under pressure to get it out soon? Because
I feel a lot of pressure, I'll tell you that. You know, it's a slow process getting these books written. And part of the challenge, to be honest, is that facts are changing so quickly and new information is coming to light so quickly that it is it's difficult to keep pace with everything that's going on right now.
So one of the better questioners, and that was reflected in a recent op-ed in the New York Times, Was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in as much as she did what, rather than grandstand, as many of the Democratic questioners did, she actually asked questions that could lead to a follow-on investigation. And I think Michael Cohen did give a bunch of leads, did he not? But the answers to her questions specifically were about asset inflation in order to get bank loans, which is against the law, and asset deflation in order to avoid taxes, which is also against the law. That was a pretty real smoking gun. What did you think?
Well, I was not surprised, but pleased to hear Deutsche Bank come up so much in Michael Cohen's testimony, both with AOC's questioning and elsewhere in the hearing. And I think there is a growing recognition in Congress, in the media, and all over America, really, that Deutsche Bank played this absolutely crucial role, not only in, you know, getting Trump money when he needed it, but really in allowing him to present himself as an accomplished, successful businessman. And as you said in the introduction, Deutsche Bank is literally the only bank that has been consistently doing business with him over the past 20 years. It's lent him hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, much of which he still owes the bank. And so if you're trying to understand Trump's personal finances or his connections to Russia or the financial interests he might have in foreign countries where the administration is pursuing policies, it's crucial to understand his relationship with Deutsche Bank.
But the reporting on Deutsche Bank goes back, and Trump's relationship to it goes back quite a way. Robert Friedman of the Village Voice wrote a book in the late 80s, Red Mafia, and he had written articles which apparently really got under Trump's skin of how many Russian gangsters were buying condos in Trump Tower beginning in 1985. And the estimates are that the Russians gangsters paid up to $100 million for condos in Trump Tower. And not only that, they started a weekly poker game at which Trump apparently, whether this is rumor or not, was allowed to win. And he was waited on hand and foot by all these Russian beauties.
Well, the Deutsche Bank's relationship with Trump really got started in a special way a bit later than that. It wasn't until the late 90s when Deutsche Bank emerged as this one bank that would do business with him. And at that point, that was a very unusual thing because Trump had defaulted not once but twice at that point on his Atlantic City casinos. He was known as a guy who had these connections or at least interactions with organized crime figures. And really, he had been locked out of the financial system after the second of his defaults in Atlantic City. And the only thing that was keeping him going was the hundreds of millions of dollars he had received from his father, Fred. And Deutsche Bank came along in the late 90s and helped him build some of his kind of marquee properties. I mean, the first was at a skyscraper at 40 Wall Street, which already existed, but he had to do this huge gut renovation. That was quickly followed by another building in Manhattan over by the UN headquarters. And then it was followed by junk bonds for his casinos, hotel in Chicago, a skyscraper in Chicago, golf courses in Florida, big hotel in Washington, D.C. And so it was just off to the races at that point. And again, this is a bank that was extremely eager to find a way to make itself kind of a household name in the United States. And they basically decided that the risks associated with Trump, which are not only that he might default, but also that he was a person of questionable character, were risks worth taking for Deutsche Bank, because that's how desperate and eager they were to make a name for themselves in the United States.
But as you point out in a recent article, Trump exaggerated his wealth in bid for loans, Michael Cohen tells Congress. You mentioned that even at Deutsche Bank, the officials would generally reduce Trump's estimates of his asset values by up to 70%. And on the building that you just mentioned, 40 Wall Street in Lower Manhattan, he valued that at $527 million. The Wall Street Journal reported the value at about $400 million. And the most flagrant of all, of course, is the property that he owns in Westchester County, known as Seven Springs, which he bought in 1996 for $7.5 million, but valued in 2010 as being worth $291 million. So,
which is just bonkers. those are essentially made-up numbers. And Deutsche Bank went through several iterations of its relationship with Trump. The first was in its investment bank. He defaulted on that loan. There's another in the commercial real estate division. He defaulted on that loan, and in that case sued the bank, blaming it for engaging in predatory lending against him, which is takes quite a bit of chutzpah to pull that claim off with a straight face. And then eventually the relationship evolved into one with the division of the bank that caters to ultra-wealthy and high-net-worth individuals. And that's where this relationship resided for the past 7 years or so. And there's one particular woman in the bank's New York offices who developed a very close relationship, not just with Trump, but with his immediate family and his extended family as well. And she became, and Deutsche Bank through her, became the sole source of credit for the Trump family. And it came at this crucial moment, because not only was Trump trying to show that he's trying to expand his empire, but he was also trying to deflect these criticisms he was getting every time he waded into the political arena, that he is a guy who has defaulted over and over again. And Hillary Clinton and Carly Fiorina both, when they were campaigning against him in 2015 and 2016, made the same joke about, you know, they've read this book about Donald Trump and all the books seem to end at chapter 11. Ha ha ha. And that was a potent line of attack, because Trump's sole credential for becoming president was that he was a successful businessman. And yet, if you looked at the actual track record of his businesses, they were not at all successful. They were littered with these huge, intractable financial problems. And yet his relationship with Deutsche Bank and the fact that the bank kept lending hundreds of millions of dollars to him over the years meant that not only was Trump allowed to still be in business, but he could say accurately that, look, one of the biggest banks on Wall Street, one of the biggest banks in the world, is not only doing business with me, but does business with me all the time, over and over again. And so that was a weapon that Trump could use to kind of insulate himself from these political attacks he was facing, and it proved to be effective.
And again, I'm speaking with David Enrich, who's a finance editor at the New York Times. He previously was the financial enterprises editor of the Wall Street Journal, heading a team of investigative reporters. And before that was the Journal's European banking editor based in London, as well as a reporter in New York. He's the author of The Spider Network, How a Math Genius and a Gang of Scheming Bankers Pulled Off One of the Greatest Scams in History. And his forthcoming book on Deutsche Bank is coming out in early 2020. So you mentioned Rosemary Vrablic, the person in Deutsche Bank who basically became Trump's personal banker. He moved into the kind of personal banking branch of Deutsche Bank, but also Deutsche Bank loaned not just billions to Trump, but also to the Kushner family. And and what was the relationship with the son of a Supreme Court justice, which I believe is the justice who retired and essentially willed his seat to Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, that's about right. And Anthony Kennedy had just joined the Supreme Court, actually, when one of his sons, Justin Kennedy, got really going in the banking industry. And Justin joined Deutsche Bank in, I believe, 1998 and spent the next 10 or 11 years there. And one of the things that Justin was doing was serving as one of the liaisons for Donald Trump. He was the one who helped do one of the biggest deals Deutsche Bank ever did for Trump, which was a loan for the construction of the Trump International Hotel and Tower in Chicago. And so Trump and Justin Kennedy developed this very close relationship, and Anthony Kennedy was kind of involved in that from time to time. He would come into Deutsche Bank's offices occasionally and say hi to people, and so he became kind of a known presence inside the bank because of his role as the son of a Supreme Court justice. And you're right, after Trump became president, when Anthony Kennedy announces right before Anthony Kennedy announces retirement, the Trump administration put on a real full court press on Anthony Kennedy to convince him that Trump was kind of a safe pair of hands to leave a Supreme Court justice in. And one of the things they did was point out the close relationship that Trump had and Trump's family had with Anthony Kennedy's son. And we don't know quite how effective that was at persuading Anthony Kennedy to retire, but it certainly didn't help. It was clear at the time, and according to a number of people I've spoken to about this, that warmed up Anthony Kennedy to Donald Trump. And you're right that Brett Kavanaugh was a former clerk of Anthony Kennedy's, and that was someone who was, and Anthony Kennedy was very happy to have Kavanaugh nominated.
So what is the Deutsche Bank's relations to the Russians? I mean, I could ask that same question about Donald Trump, because that might well be at the heart of the Mueller investigation. But what are the ties there, since they paid huge fines for laundering Russian money?
Well, Deutsche Bank's relationship with Russia goes back many, many decades, and they've had business there since right after World War II, basically, when they were helping to build natural gas pipelines for the Russians. And it kept developing through the 80s and the 90s. Deutsche Bank helped, was kind of played a behind-the-scenes role in helping one of the Kremlin's biggest banks, a state-owned bank, get into investment banking. Deutsche Bank hired a very senior, the son of a very senior Putin-connected oligarch. A number of Deutsche Bank people went over to this Russian bank and to help them get their business started. And then around 2010, 2011, Deutsche Bank...
Hello, did we lose you? I think we lost our connection here. Could you quickly call back?
Converting the
ruble. Oh, no, wait a second.
All went through Deutsche Bank, both in Europe and the United States. And this was billions of dollars went through Deutsche Bank's pipes. And this happens to have been around the same time that Deutsche Bank's lending to Donald Trump was picking up steam. And that may well be a coincidence. The evidence of those things being connected is at best circumstantial. There's not any proof, at least that I've seen, that Deutsche Bank was serving as a vehicle for Russian cash to get to Donald Trump. There's tons of evidence that Deutsche Bank was serving as a vehicle for illicit Russian cash flows, but we have not been able to connect that to Donald Trump. And I know that is one of the many things that a couple of congressional committees are starting to investigate. And look, I consider myself to be a pretty good journalist. Unfortunately, I do not have subpoena power. And so that it puts limits on the amount of information I can get out of the bank or anyone else. These congressional committees, now that the Democrats are chairing them and have subpoena power, are in a much better position to answer some of those questions.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, the story of Bill Brokmeier, the American executive who was regarded as the conscience of Deutsche Bank, who in 2014 was found hanging in his London apartment, and his son apparently went on a quest to understand why his father, or if his father, killed himself. That sort of turns this story somewhat into a movie, doesn't it? I mean...
I hope so. I really hope so. So the guy, Bill Brokmeier, as you said, was one of the most senior people at the bank. He was found dead in early 2014. And very shortly after he died, within a few days, I was in London at the time, and I got in touch with his son, Val. And over the next, 5 years, we kind of built this very strong relationship, and I followed along as Val went on this international quest to figure out what had happened to his dad and why. And as part of that, Val obtained many hundreds, if not thousands, of his father's emails and electronic documents related to Deutsche Bank. And so that has provided quite a bit of clues about the true nature of this bank and some of the problems that were going on inside of it. And it's the type of problems that led to this extraordinary relationship with Donald Trump.
And any resolution there? I mean, this is a lot of people have turned up dead.
You're going to have to wait for the book on that.
I know. But I was going to say, a lot of people have turned up dead in the UK at the hands of Russian assassins.
Yeah, no, I have no indication that Russian assassins were involved in this. I think he, by all accounts, he committed suicide. The question is why.
I see.
And and readers of my book will be able to get that answer.
So how can readers of or potential readers of your book get in touch with you to urge you to get this book finished? Because inquiring minds want to know about Deutsche Bank and its relationship to Donald Trump.
The easiest thing to do is just go to my Twitter page, which is at David Enrich, and you'll find a link where you can pre-order the book and read a little more about it. I'm also on Facebook and LinkedIn as well. And so there are links there that you can follow to pre-order or read more about it.
Well, thank you for joining us, David Enrich.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with David Enrich, who's a finance editor at the New York Times. He previously was the financial enterprise editor of the Wall Street Journal, heading a team of investigative reporters. And before that was the Journal's European banking editor based in London, as well as a reporter in New York. He's the author of The Spider Network, How a Math Genius and a Gang of Scheming Bankers Pulled Off One of the Greatest Scams in History. And his forthcoming book on Deutsche Bank is coming out in early 2020. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into what Democratic candidates running for president can do to neutralize the orchestrated Republican attack on progressive candidates labeled as socialists, with socialism being defined as what is happening in Venezuela.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mike Lux, the president of American Family Voices and a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House and is the author of The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. And his latest book is How to Democrat in the Age of Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lux.
Thank you, Ian. It's always good to be on.
Well, thanks, Mike. And what do you mean by how to Democrat as opposed to how to be a Democrat?
Well, we believe that the word Democrat needs to be turned into a verb in this case, that we need to be a party of action, of moving things. And so we just decided to make that play on words. I think Democrats need to take a very aggressive, very, very active point of view right now. And we should have always been the party of change. I don't know that we've always succeeded in that. But I think especially now that's very much where we need to be.
Well, based upon what was on display at the CPAC conference over the weekend in Washington, D.C.,
yeah,
the Conservative Political Action Committee, where Trump made an over two-hour-long speech full of anger and grievance and obscenities, for that matter, which is pretty unusual, if not unprecedented, yeah, for an American president to curse like this. One of the speakers, of course, the fascist, I think is a fair way to describe him, or at least a man with unusual fascist sympathies. Former White House advisor Sebastian Gorka said,
yeah,
they want to take your pickup truck. They want to take away your hamburgers. Now, I can't imagine this sort of undisclosed location in the desert where the Democrats have piled up millions of hamburgers and pickup trucks and impounded them. But the specter of socialism is being, the drum has been beaten now. And in coincidence or at the same time as Trump was speaking, Bernie Sanders was announcing beginning of his campaign in Brooklyn. So how are the Democrats going to deal with the S word, which the Republicans, they did it under Obama, by the way. It's nothing new.
Of course. There was a great article, and I do talk about this in my book, The Progressive Revolution, but there was a great article recently by Ron Klain, who is considered sort of a centrist Democrat. You know, he worked for Joe Biden and Al Gore, and he talked about how Republicans have been calling Democrats centrists for a long time, and in fact, that phrase was first used to describe the Democratic candidate all the way back in 1896. William Jennings Bryan was called a socialist, FDR was certainly called a socialist, and
pretty much every Democrat since then. And the funny thing about it for me is that one of the polling trends that I noticed in the 2008 race was that the Republicans were calling Obama a socialist so much that a lot of young people especially were like, well, if Obama's a socialist and I kind of like Obama, I guess that must mean I'm a socialist. So the people who self-identified as socialists in that period, went up dramatically. So this kind of thing is old news, and I don't think it's something that we need to worry about very much. I do think that what we need to be thoughtful is how we describe our policies, and we need to be clear that we are all about helping people. We are all about being strong progressives, and you can call that whatever you want, but it's got to be oriented towards working class voters. And that's not one of the dumb things that sometimes happen, and I talk about this in the How to Democrat book. People are like, well, should we focus on the working class or should we focus on the base? Well, it's the same thing. The Democratic base is people of color, is young people, is unmarried women voters, for example. All of those are working class constituencies. You don't have to pick. It's a stupid false choice. We need to focus on working class voters and of all races, you know, of all ages, of all regions, urban and rural, and suburban, and we need to go get all of them.
Well, it would seem to me that the best way to take down this phony label that where the Republicans are trying to say that if you vote for a Democrat, you're voting for Maduro chaos in Venezuela. Why not turn it around? And to some extent, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did in questioning Michael Cohen. She pointed out that she drives by in her precinct. She drives by a golf course owned by Trump, which I believe the local council put something like $150 million of taxpayers' money into, got nothing in return except all the money went to Trump. And, you know, a golf course for a bunch of, you know, wealthy doctors and lawyers and dentists to do recreation in is not the same as taking care of all your constituents and filling the potholes, etc. I think that's a very strong argument that we do have socialism in this country, but it's right-wing socialism.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the best things about socialism are things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, right? For that matter, public works, highways, roads, bridges, public schools, all of that could be called socialist and in fact is creating social capital and social good, public good. But they want to, as you say, they want to say that every socialist idea is going to lead directly to Maduro. But the fact is that, as you point out, Ian, rich people and big corporations get far more subsidies, far more direct benefit from the government than working class folks. And that's one of the reasons why people get upset at the government and people have lost faith in the government. When Trump's golf course gets huge subsidies and everyday working people are struggling to make ends meet, it doesn't make any sense. And you can go down, you can look at the tax loopholes that are given. You can look at the special rates that are given on capital gains and carried interest. You can look at the subsidies various big businesses are given. You can look at the federal government's help in getting trade deals that benefit some of the biggest businesses. I mean, there's example after example of big business and wealthy folks getting huge subsidies and the rest of us not getting much, and so I do think we have to address that directly and make it clear what's really going on.
Well, as appalling as Trump is, and the CPAC speech was a new low, although the bar keeps getting lowered, and we know yeah. that he's lied thousands of times. It's hard to keep up. And yet the Republicans all jumped on Michael Cohen as a liar, and they are all clearly covering up for Trump in the way that Cohen covered up for Trump. Whether that yeah. irony will eventually filter down into the consciousness, I don't know. I don't understand why so many Trump supporters are so absolutely loyal to him in a cult-like manner. His popularity amongst Republicans is still way up there, 80-90%. I'm not sure what the latest figures are, but it seems to be immovable. He seems to have his people fired up. They're impervious to facts and evidence. So the idea that he could be reelected is a frightening idea. So mm-hmm. tell me that the Democrats aren't going to blow it this time.
Well, Ian, one never knows with the Democrats. For those of us who believe in God, we should definitely pray that they don't. But we also, we just need to get to work in framing the message, telling a story, telling about what the Democratic Party's basic identity should be. And what's one of the things I talk about in my book is that I believe in the, you know, in the Clinton years, we drifted away from what the party was from our, you know, from very early days, which was the whole idea of the Democratic Party. The reason it was called the Democratic Party is that we were the party for more democracy. We were the party that was fighting the Wall Street bankers back in the 1790s. We were the party that was fighting for more people getting the right to vote. We were the party that was fighting for public education. And we were not by any means far, far from being perfect, because we bought into slavery and all that crap that was around in that era. But when you look at the history of the party, we were to an extent the party of the people, and we drifted away from that. We drifted away from FDR's New Deal and Harry Truman's advocacy of national health care and JFK and LBJ's advocacy of civil rights and Medicare and Medicaid and the Voting Rights Act. We drifted away, and we kind of became this mushy centrist party without a real identity. And I think that is why we've had such a hard time over the last 25 years in terms of winning elections up and down the ballot. We've won some presidential elections. We occasionally have a good year, but we've lost far more than we should have. And it's because we drifted from that basic identity, and we have to go get that back. We have to show people that we really are the party of the people, that we are the party of working class folks, the party of people who pick up garbage and teach and farm and work hard for a living. And I think if we do that, we will win the next election. If we pick a candidate who represents those ideas and that identity and those values, we will win the next election. So part of it might be a little bit of prayer, and part of it might just be picking the right candidates and really having a strong message going into the next election.
Well, in terms of picking the right candidates, there's going to be an awfully wide choice, is there not? At least 20, maybe more. A bunch of governors.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a wild year. We've already had more candidates announced than have ever run before, and there's quite a few people who are strongly considering it who have not yet announced. So it is going to be a wild year. We'll have to see, you know, how it all shakes out. I'm trying to get my head around, you know, this many people traipsing through small states like Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada. They're going to be bumping into each other every day. So it's going to be strange. And we do have a wide range of choices. I think, you know, the good news is that they all want to expand healthcare, you know, coverage. They all want to, I think with a couple of exceptions, tax wealthy people more. They all want to invest more in education. They all want to do something about climate change. And so there's a lot of good things happening in terms of that. I personally, though, I really hope that we pick a candidate who is more progressive, who is more populist, and who can really speak to, you know, the real issues that matter to working class folks, to poor folks, because I think that is key to winning the election. I don't think a mushy centrist who doesn't, you know, define where they're at on key issues is the answer in terms of winning this election.
Well, in terms of candidates, presidential candidates on the Democratic side bumping into each other, that seems to be happening on Sunday in Selma, Alabama, where John Lewis is leading the commemoration of the Civil Rights March on the Pattis Bridge 54 years ago, where he was almost beaten to death. Cory Booker is there, Bernie Sanders is there, and also Sherrod Brown is there. Has he actually declared? I mean, he's currently
no,
on the...
No, he has not. He hasn't made the final decision yet, as to whether he wants to run. And I think that's genuine. I think he's still thinking about it.
Right, but he's on a tour, though, isn't he? It's called the Dignity of Work Tour, which was inspired by Martin Luther King.
Yes, exactly.
So is that going to sort of morph into a campaign, the Dignity of Work? I mean, he's got some good working class credentials. He seems like a regular guy. How do you see?
I think he is. I will say up front that Sherrod Brown is one of the people that I'm, you know, personally closest to, who's running or thinking about running, and that I've been kind of talking through with him and his potential team about what a campaign might look like. So I'm biased in this regard, but I've always liked Sherrod because from the very first moment he got to Washington, he was fighting against bad trade deals like NAFTA. He was fighting for higher wages for working people. He voted against the Defense of Marriage Act that Bill Clinton and everybody else signed, even though he's from Ohio, which is a more conservative state on those issues. He voted against the Iraq War, even though most of the leadership of the Democratic Party supported it in the early 2000s. So he's been a really gutsy, progressive guy from the very beginning, but he has an ability to listen to and talk to working class folks like those in Ohio. And he's the only Democrat in that state who's won a statewide election since 2006. He's just got the ability, even in spite of his strong progressive record. People there who are more conservative on a lot of things. I mean, as you know, Ian, Ohio went strongly for Trump last time, but a candidate like Sherrod has the ability to reach them, and I think that's the kind of candidate that we need in this presidential election.
But if he gives up his Senate seat to run for president, the Republicans will pick up a seat, won't they?
No, not necessarily. I think that he doesn't have to give up the seat to run, only to win. I think if he wins the presidency, he's going to have there'll be a special election for the Senate seat. He's going to have a lot of influence, and I think might be able to help a Democrat win that special election.
Well, just in closing, the front runner at this point in terms of polling and certainly in terms of donations is Bernie Sanders. He raked in $10 million in less than a week. So he's the front runner. And it's sort of interesting in a way that he inspired a lot of people to run. And now they're running, the younger ones are running against him. Is that an irony?
Well, it is a little bit ironic. I think part of it, frankly, is that with everybody taking a pass 4 years ago, except for Bernie, none of these other folks decided to run against her because they thought she couldn't be beat. And Bernie, I don't think Bernie actually thought he would win when he entered the race, but he wanted somebody to be raising these issues. And then he caught on much more than anybody, including him, thought he would. And the result has been that he's been, I mean, if you look at the polling, he has been the most popular politician in America over the last several years, consistently. And so he is the kind of candidate that I think would do well. And I know there's a lot of Democrats who don't think that's true, but I think Bernie could be a great candidate. And I think you're right. I think right now he's the front runner.
Well, Mark Lux, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me, Ian. I love being on.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Lux, who's president of American Family Voices and a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House and is the author of The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. And his latest book is How to Democrat in the Age of Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Trump's vow that he would strip colleges of funding if they don't support his version of free speech.
Don't need to change the futures are. You don't need to change.
Oh, give us your vote. Give us your vote.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Plain Radical, Living, Loving, and Learning to Leave the Planet Gracefully, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. And his latest book is The End of Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Jensen.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And President Trump at the CPAC conference over the weekend said that he's going to issue a executive order that will strip colleges of funding if they don't support free speech. He said if they want our dollars and we give it to them by the billions, they've got to allow people like Hayden, talking about Hayden Williams, who was physically attacked last month on the Berkeley campus, let people like Hayden and many young people and old people to speak. And then he said the executive order would require colleges to support free speech if they want federal research. And he planned to sign it very soon. And the federal government does distribute more than $26 billion a year to colleges and universities for research purposes. So how is that going to work in assuming Trump can actually make this happen?
Yeah, so when Donald, first of all, I think it's important to acknowledge that when Donald Trump advocates for free speech, we all should take a little break and chuckle a bit, because, of course, Donald Trump has never been an advocate for free speech in his life. You know, Donald Trump has threatened to intensify libel laws, to go after journalists. He's encouraged people in the audience to physically assault journalists. You know, I mean, Trump is no friend of free speech, obviously. But if one wants to take seriously the question, in some sense, for at least public universities, such an order would have essentially no effect, because public universities, that is, universities like the University of Texas, where I spent my career, are already bound by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which protects free speech. So it's not entirely clear what Trump is saying, because while the threat of removing research funding is serious, of course, it's hard to imagine what an executive order would demand that isn't already implied in the First Amendment.
So that's one. Now, if he did issue such an executive order, the main groups that would be affected would be private universities, because private schools, that is, ones that are not funded by the state, currently do not have to meet the First Amendment's expectations. So in a funny way, it might have the most effect not only on private schools, but on religious schools, because religious schools would then, if one took it seriously, have to meet the First Amendment, and that, you know, would cause all sorts of problems. So Donald Trump, of course, was throwing a little bit of meat to his base, beating up on liberals, beating up on colleges. Those are kind of go-to insults for him. But it's hard to take it too seriously. It's hard to imagine how such an order would be written, how it would be enforced. I don't feel like it's much of a threat. I feel it's more like a talking point for a speech to a conservative group.
Well, already there are well-funded conservatives like David Horowitz, who's tour campuses all the time, whipping up support for right-wing causes. And, you know, he's an exemplar of how there's so much more money on the right than there is on the left. You know, he used to be the editor of Ramparts magazine, which was a scrappy San Francisco radical newspaper during the Vietnam War, and obviously living hand to mouth with all those sort of hippies running it. And then he decided one day to become a prodigal son and become a hero of the right, and they just thrown money at him like crazy, and he's able to use this well-oiled machine to go around on campuses and stir up support amongst young right-wingers and recruit them. So my sense is that the right is doing pretty well. They don't need Trump's help if indeed he can divert federal dollars to right-wing free speech, which is, I assume, what he wants. He doesn't want full-spectrum free speech, does he?
Well, I don't think it's I don't think it's about free speech at all. I think it's just a passing phase for Trump in a speech, because, as you pointed out, there was a right wing organizer on the Berkeley campus who got punched out. And so it gives him a little platform from which to speak. But your point about Horowitz is, I think, the real important one, because you're looking at, you know, the sociology and history of this. So the right wing is, both in regard to the university and to the media, always used this idea that these institutions hate ordinary people, they're contemptuous of conservative ideas, and therefore that's why the media and the universities, you know, must be reined in. But of course, you know, the U.S. news media, the mainstream media, is hardly, you know, a secret cell of the Communist Party. It's a deeply conservative institution in that larger sense. And universities, to some degree, are as well. You know, the people running most major universities are not lefties. They're very centrist to right-leaning people. So the right wing targets the universities and the media in a very, I think, deceptive way. But we should recognize that there is always a kind of kernel of truth to it. So take Horowitz. Horowitz was fond of saying that universities were a kind of becoming ideological, on especially on questions like diversity, race, and gender and things. And there is a kernel of truth to that, that some of the ways that the modern university has changed in general in a positive way to account for the racism and sexism that's so much a part of this country. But in some ways, they've accounted for it in ham-handed ways by, you know, speech codes and handbooks that warn people against offensive speech and all sorts of things that can lead to a climate that does limit instead of expand the kind of conversations we want to see on campuses. So if you go around university campuses today, on no shortage of them, you'll find a kind of liberal dogma around some of these issues, and you'll find conservative students who feel shut down in class. That's not just a figment of Donald Trump's imagination. That is happening. And so, once again, I think the response of the left, and, you know, someone who considers himself a part of the left now for the last 30 years, the appropriate response is not to try to shut down or write overly restrictive codes, but to open up. And so Horowitz is a great example. When Horowitz came to my university maybe 20 years ago, all of the left-wing students wanted to protest to have him shut down. And I thought, well, that's just an ineffective response. Why not go and debate Horowitz instead? Why not show up and engage him? So I think the left is too easily drawn into a kind of a trap where the right wing claims they're being suppressed, and the left, you know, when people like Charles Murray or Milo Yiannopoulos show up, immediately revert to exactly that, to try to shut them down. And the result, of course, is the right wing propaganda machine wins from that.
So in the University of Texas, Austin's a sort of a little anomaly, isn't it? Kind of a liberal bubble, I guess a blue bubble in a red state. Although Texas is turning from purple. Well, I don't know whether it's purple yet, but let's assume that it's turning towards blue. What's your sense of where, you know, the political alignment of forces, if you will, the battle of, you know, the order of battle, as they stay in the military, between the left and the right? The left have more recruits, don't they? They're more – young people tend to be more idealistic and less Chamber of Commerce-type thinkers.
Yeah. So, you know, the University of Texas, where I spent 26 years teaching, I'm now in my first year of retirement, is kind of a good example of this. So Austin itself is a bit of a liberal bubble in an otherwise conservative state. But when I came to the University of Texas in 92, you know, the administration was still pretty much, you know, a kind of centrist conservative administration reflecting not only the state, but reflecting also, you know, big state universities. They don't, as I said, don't tend to be run by, you know, lefties. There was a shift. People were starting to be a little more conscious of the effects of, you know, white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, the effects of that on constraining ideas. The 60s had had an effect. They came a little late to Texas, but they got here. And people were pushing for a kind of challenge to the way the university had always run. And so for those 26 years I was here, I think the left in some sense made progress. There was a Black Studies degree established, women's studies expanded. But in that time also, you could see that the university administration understood that these concerns were real. And instead of the university as an institution taking on white supremacy in Texas, let's say, which is, of course, still very much a feature of the state, it adopted kind of tepid codes, you know, codes of conduct, speech codes of sorts, that really don't deal with the deep problem of white supremacy, but they police the way people speak. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. I think the way people speak in a university is important. I think people can use language that creates an atmosphere in which not all people are able to learn. I think racist language in the classroom, right, needs to be disciplined in some settings. But the problem is the university goes for the easiest way to do this, which is to write codes rather than to actually engage in a critique of white supremacy. And as a result, then, the tide has shifted a bit. And I think the liberals, even to some degree the left on campus, at least in these arenas around race and gender, would feel like they have the high ground right now. And so that gives these conservatives an argument that they're being persecuted and suppressed. So I think the universities, I'm kind of an old lefty in this sense, thinking back to the 60s when the left fought for an expanded space for freedom of expression on campuses. I think universities should be a really robust place for this. This is one place where kind of liberal free speech values, I think, are really important. Of course, they always have to be balanced with the awareness that people can create an atmosphere in any place, especially a university, that shuts down people from minority groups, for instance. So, you know, it's always a balance and it's never easy. I think the right is silly when it claims that free speech is under assault. But I think the left should be careful about pretending there aren't real issues that need to be debated here.
But just in the last couple of minutes, there's some very scary trends, though, in terms of free speech in the sense, well, not that it has anything to do with free speech, but there are groups emerging
that are just incomprehensible. For example, this character, Jordan Peterson, has become a sort of father figure to these alienated young men, who some of whom are in that incel category. The incels in themselves are just absolutely bizarre, but this young incel killed a whole bunch of people on the campus of University of California, Santa Barbara. A good friend of mine, she's under attack by the incels, and she has to have physical protection. One incel killed a bunch of people in Toronto, drove a car and killed a bunch of young women. They hate women. I mean, you know, on the one hand, you sort of have to tolerate these ideas, but boy, are some of these ideas on the fringes, and not to mention Alex Jones as well. So it's a difficult thing to navigate, isn't it, between Alex Jones and the incels, giving them freedom at the same time, being somewhat bemused by excessive political correctness.
Absolutely. So you're identifying a real problem, that there can be speech that essentially is so connected to acts of violence that it's hard to separate the speech from the violence. And the law has always had trouble drawing that line. When does something move from simply being an expression of idea to really incitement to violence? Well, the Supreme Court's wrestled with that over the years. And to say it's hard, of course, doesn't mean that we don't have to resolve it. So I think you're right about that. It's also true that with the kind of routine degradation of certain groups, there can be times where the state should come in and discipline people for what we typically call hate speech. The balance there is also tricky. But this is true of all speech law. It's about drawing lines in ways that one is never 100% happy with having to draw a line. You can point to all sorts of other things going on in this culture. For instance, the attempt to shut down the BDS movement that challenges Israel, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, by literally making advocacy of that political strategy impossible. In Texas, we've got a version of that. You can see it around the debate around transgender issues, where radical feminists who have a critique of the ideology behind the trans movement are being shut down on campus. Well, one of those, the BDS, the attack on BDS, comes from the right. On the other, the attack on an open debate about the trans issue comes from the left. So we can see that the threats do come from lots of places. But I think your main point at the beginning is right, that the most serious threats to free speech tend to come from the right. And the right is where the money exists to overwhelm the space with, you know, propaganda, advertising, the funding of groups. So I think for the left, the takeaway for me is hold true to true free speech advocacy and continue to look for strategies to undermine the right wing when it uses these kind of tricks to present itself as subordinated, suppressed, or persecuted. There's one thing that's pretty clear living in Texas: the right wing is not persecuted.
Well, on that note, Robert Jensen, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue, and his latest book is The End of Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. The headline written down in America.
Tonight.